From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
We have to bring relief as fast as possible to people who are struggling under Obamacare.
What do Republicans intend to put in its place?
Patient-centered health care that gets everybody access to affordable health care coverage so that they can buy what they want to buy.
Mr. Wong described the phone call between Mr. Trump and Ms. Tsai as a little trick or shenanigan by the Taiwan government.
Boeing's already signed a deal to build the new ones. There's a pair of them, 747s.
North Carolina man is under arrest, accused of firing an assault rifle inside a Washington, D.C. pizzeria.
They're buoyant, happy at the news that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers won't allow the Dakota Access Pipeline to cross the Missouri River north of their reservation.
Those are some of the stories we've been listening to and looking at throughout the course of the week. You can join our conversation about the week's news, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. I want to welcome in today, as always, Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Mark Pasdio, because he's Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Hello there, Paz.
Good morning, John.
And also Leah Wright-Rigger. She's Assistant Professor of Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Good to see you back in person, Leah.
Always good to be here in Hartford.
Well, there's some big news this morning. Yes, we always wait anxiously for what Time Magazine is going to do for their Person of the Year. And Colin, Time Magazine has named, probably not terribly surprisingly, Donald Trump as Person of the Year. Number two on the list was Hillary Clinton. Number three on the list was the hackers, according to Time. What do you make of the pick of Donald Trump? I suppose it's probably the pick that we all thought was going to happen.
Yeah, bearing in mind, you know, their criteria have to do with who was the biggest newsmaker, who had the biggest impact. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how they could have picked anybody else. This is his ascent affects in gigantic ways, not only in the United States, but it affects other countries. I mean, if you talk to people in other countries, they not only believe that his policies will affect them, but it also affects the political climate in those countries as, you know, people whose candidacies somewhat resemble his feel emboldened and empowered and more plausible.
And I suppose in a couple of minutes, Leah will probably be talking a bit about the way in which he's already affecting some of those foreign countries with his communications before he even becomes president.
Right. He is the Twitterer in chief. And I think we are getting a preview of what his presidency will look like. We saw what it looked like on the campaign. And if anything, I think part of what we have to do in the media is reevaluate how social media and how Twitter really has become a medium for somebody with as much power as Donald Trump, and what that you know foretells or bodes for the future. I'm not too optimistic about it.
You know, Paz, we've talked about this a couple times now in The Wheelhouse. It's sort of hard to ignore. I wanted to get your take on this. How do you approach covering a politician who is using this weird medium of Twitter that's been around for a little bit to essentially make some policy pronouncements, to say things that we're either supposed to pay attention to or not pay attention to? How do you pick and choose as someone who covers the news on a daily basis about what to look at and what to sort of avoid?
Can I first compliment Colin for not noting that Adolf Hitler was Time's Man of the Year in 1938? I thought that showed incredible restraint.
It was incredible restraint.
Although
yes.
I believe he's tweeting it right now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this has been the challenge for really the national press. You know, we don't run into that here in Connecticut. We are not terribly worried about the governor tweeting. Our governor does not tweet. But in Trump's case, it's a legitimate thing. I mean, he can move markets. He has moved markets based on a tweet. He took a shot at Boeing over the price of the next generation of Air Force One, and Boeing's stock price immediately went down. You know, there was immediately speculation that what Donald Trump really was saying is telling the executives at Boeing to shut the hell up about his shots at China. They are terrified he's going to start a trade war with China. And oh, by the way, they sell airplanes in China.
Well, and I'm wondering, Colin, this really does get back to a lot of statewide policy that we talk about. Every single time a company wants to leave Connecticut, we have a conversation about whether or not the state needs to step up and give it tax breaks and how much corporate welfare is out there. Donald Trump has taken this, even before he becomes president, to this entirely new level. As Paz said, you know, Boeing's price, stock price can be affected. When he makes a call or takes a call from Taiwan, it actually affects markets, and China gets people fairly scared. What should we think about U.S. policy when it comes to keeping businesses here, what businesses might expect out of a Trump presidency, because this really is new territory, and it really does affect big manufacturers like Boeing and United Technologies.
Right. So there's like 18 things in the box that you just opened, right? A whole bunch of different things. So just to the point of the tweets for a second, you know, I mean, Steve Inskeep was interviewing Stephen Moore who's this morning, who's one of Trump's economic advisors. And at one point, Moore said, well, you know, this whole issue of cost overruns or things that just cost way too much money in government is something that Donald Trump takes very seriously. And I was kind of waiting for Inskeep, who did a really good job with this interview, to say, well, is Twitter a serious place? I mean, in other words, if he has serious concerns about this, is 140 characters kind of the right way to deal with something that you're serious about? And I think that question needs to be asked over and over again. I don't know what we're going to do about it. Jack Schaefer, who's a press critic for Politico now, he is advocating just not reporting and fact-checking every single thing. I think I mentioned this last week in the Wheelhouse. But, you know, as far as the economic part of this goes, ultimately the people are going to decide how they feel about this stuff. And it's going to be easier for Donald Trump to overplay his hand than he thinks. I mean, right now, I believe the popular vote margin is 2.7 million. Hillary Clinton she's now approaching the popular vote, one of Obama's popular vote margins, except that he won and she lost. So he doesn't have this tremendous mandate that he seems to think he does. And I think ultimately, I mean, it might not happen this week or next week. It might happen a year or two in when he's not a new toy anymore and people have kind of – the novelty has worn off. But people are going to look at stuff like this where, you know, he slams Boeing, the stock plummets. I think there's a chance that people will turn against him and regard his behavior as arbitrary, capricious, self-interested, and reckless, all of which it absolutely is.
Yeah, so I think people are already there. The concern has always been, you know, Donald Trump's supporters, his most loyal supporters. We've talked about in the show before how I think, you know, almost a year ago, we said his supporters are more loyal than any other supporters of any other candidate. And so long as he has that core group of supporters who I think who are united or wedded to him and unapologetic about him, I would be very concerned about tipping the scales of, you know, of how people feel about him. He's already the most unpopular president, right, president-elect that we've ever had. The question becomes, since we've used all of these traditional mediums to criticize him that have worked, right, people don't like him, people don't trust him, people think he's untrustworthy. And yet there's still this interesting pathway which he was able to achieve the presidency. Now what we're also seeing, I think, is that we're seeing that the Trump Organization outside of the White House is trying to do with what Obama for America did, right? So organize a, you know, almost a lobbying group or a mobilizing group with Kellyanne Conway at the helm. I would be very concerned about that, particularly since we've seen that the normal things that derail politicians or that politician accountability, right, doesn't necessarily work, and that in an era, post-fact era, right, we don't have – there's not the same kind of sway that we've seen with other politicians or with other politicians in the past.
You know,
can I just follow up on one thing? I think what you're saying is really important, and I think the other thing we have to acknowledge is there's a couple of pain points coming up here. Now, if you're right, if it moves that fast, the public discontent, then it becomes an issue in the midterm elections. Then you've got constituencies, and some of them Republican constituencies, saying either rein this guy in or lose your seat. You know, otherwise it waits another 2 years and becomes a 2020 issue. But that's the point that you're making, and the speed at which that happens, which I think is tough to measure right now, is a really interesting question.
To your point about accountability, I'm going to throw this out. I mean, he has not been inaugurated yet, but I'm going to talk about 4 years hence. He is the oldest person to ever assume the office of the presidency. He has shown repeatedly that he has, shall we say, a degree of ambivalence towards the idea of being confined in the White House, being confined by the most demanding job in the world. I don't think it's unreasonable to look at him as somebody who's saying, I'm going to do this for a term. And if that is the case, if that is his mindset, there will be less accountability. You know, I don't think this is somebody who is particularly loyal to the Republican Party as a continuing enterprise. So,
one way to put it.
So, yes, losses in the midterm elections, which, by the way, that's the normal pattern for the party in power of the White House to lose seats. But to what extent would Trump truly be troubled by that? It certainly would hobble his last 2 years of a first term. But I don't know, because let's be honest, there is no book on this guy. There are no guideposts to figure out what's coming around the next bend.
Well,
if he loses the majority, he'll have to hire Dick Morrison, triangulate, right?
Yeah, there you go.
We know how this works.
And just looping quickly back, Leah, to the tweets, and the reason this is important, you know, Colin raises the question, is 140 characters the place where you do something very, very important? I think a counterargument is when you have a couple million people reading all of your tweets and you can directly communicate with people in a way that no one's ever been able to communicate with before, you're able to get, even in those small bites, and maybe that's what he's good at, little bits of policy out there that people will then follow. This is a new way of communicating, and you directly communicate 140 characters or not with a whole lot of people at one time.
Right. And so I think that is it's not necessarily just Twitter either, right? So it's Facebook and the importance of social media in general in this, you know, technological age. And I think so, you know, there were a couple studies that say, well, not a lot of people in the United States use social media, et cetera, but in terms of how it circulates, right, and how it gets picked up, maybe one out of four people uses it, but then those people spread it, those people share it over text, those people see it on the news, those people see it on the nightly news. It becomes a way of communication about very, very serious issues. It also becomes, and I know we may talk about this later in the show, but it becomes a way of transferring false information in very rapid ways, right? So this is how we go from the fringes to the mainstream. And so this is what this kind of jockeying for, well, do we cover every single tweet? Do we think about this? I actually think there is a way that you can cover serious news, right? Traditional serious news, but also look at what Donald Trump is saying in these tweets and try and hold him accountable, even if you feel like the seriousness of it is not, is not meaty enough.
I was going to say the serious issues that we always have when a new president comes in is what his picks are going to be for his cabinet. He's made several each week as we've been talking. As Defense Secretary James Mattis, this has led past Richard Blumenthal, Senator of Connecticut, to raise some concerns because Mattis hasn't been out of the military all that long. Dick Blumenthal saying it's a bedrock of our democracy that the guy who runs defense is someone who comes from the civilian sector. Trump seems to think that Congress is going to give him a waiver for that for James Mattis.
Well, I think the assumption correctly is Congress will give him a waiver given the numbers in Congress. And I don't know if would the Democrats try to mount a filibuster over the waiver issue. But I mean, Blumenthal's issue was not James Mattis's qualifications, but he said, let's take some time and look at this very important principle of civilian oversight over the Department of Defense. Kirsten Gillibrand in New York already has said she will not vote for the waiver. So Senator Blumenthal said the other day he wants to see General Mattis address this issue. Let us know, you know, basically to have him acknowledge the importance of civilian oversight over the Department of Defense, and then he was going to play it from there. But at this point, he certainly sounds like somebody who is disinclined to vote for the waiver.
You know, Mad Dog, I like calling him Mad Dog. Mad Dog Mattis, he has at least one other problem, which is that I think in 2012 he was advocating a possible battlefield use of the technology of this company, Theranos. Theranos is the Elizabeth Holmes company that is just in complete collapse, lawsuits, federal investigations. By 2013, I may have the dates a little bit wrong, he was on the board, and I think he's still on the board of Theranos. So that might come up in hearings too. I think Paz is right. There isn't the firepower to do anything about this, but what you do is you make a stand and you fight the good fight and you ask a lot of pointed questions and ultimately you sweat the person. And I think you're going to see Gillibrand and Blumenthal and a whole bunch of other people do that. Because this 7-year waiver, I mean, yeah, it hasn't been used since George Marshall. When it was used for George Marshall, it was used reluctantly and the Congress attached to it at the time kind of language saying, this isn't something we'd want to get into the habit of doing. I'm paraphrasing. So, the only reason to do this now is because Donald Trump feels like having this guy. Like there isn't some other pressing national concern where we couldn't get somebody else to be Secretary of Defense.
When we're talking about maybe being able to get somebody else to run something, we have Ben Carson, who wasn't necessarily sure, Leah, that he was suited to work in government because he didn't have enough experience. Now it looks like he's going to head up an agency that many people are questioning whether or not he has the experience to head, the Housing and Urban Development.
Yeah, and it's also just come out, according to Armstrong Williams, that you know, the rationale that they've been giving that Ben Carson is great for this job is that he grew up in public housing, that he actually did not grow up in public housing. So, you know, that one goes out of the window as well.
Did he try to hit his mother with a hammer?
We have not figured that out. We have to go back and take a look at Gifted Hands. So I think the interesting thing here is that, one, we've had, we've had black HUD secretaries before, right? We've had Robert Weaver during the Johnson administration, and we've had Samuel Pierce during the Reagan administration. I think this is going into this, this is a cautionary tale. Samuel Pierce was extremely, extremely, I think, qualified for a position in the cabinet, although he did not want the position in HUD. He said, I have no experience in HUD. I'm better for the, you know, a Supreme Court or attorney general. And what we saw was a department awash in corruption by the end of the 8 years. It was just a disaster. It was a lobbyist playground. And this is from somebody who was at odds with Ronald Reagan's point of view, right? So it was a liberal Republican as opposed to a conservative Republican. So we actually have no idea what could happen, but it's not looking good. You don't put somebody who has zero experience in charge of a massive and important government agency. I'm particularly taken by, you know, Carson saying earlier on that he didn't have the experience to be Health and Human Services, head of Health and Human Services or health education, but feels right at home doing, you know, housing and urban development. That to me seems like a pretty huge red flag considering the position.
Well, yeah, and actually in making that first comment about – I mean, let's go back for a second. Ben Carson's overall demeanor and deportment during the campaign had the effect on me of making me profoundly grateful that he was not my neurosurgeon, as opposed to hoping he could expand his talents into other fields that he hasn't previously explored. I mean, he's just a disturbingly weird person. When Leah's talking about when he said maybe he wouldn't be the right choice for HHS, for which there's at least kind of a plausible argument you can make, he said he didn't want to cripple the government with his inexperience. Now, what changed? Apparently what changed was Donald Trump was so nice to him. Donald Trump took him out and bought him ice cream and told him he was great. And so that now he's ready to run HUD. I mean, this is silliness. It's such silliness that it's hard to have a serious conversation about this. And it makes you wonder what will happen in a lot of these departments where there is a so-called permanent government. You know, there's a lot of people in there who've been there a long time, who understand what the policies are and how they work. I do think for some of these guys who come in who are complete novices, and you couldn't be more raw than Ben Carson, it may be a while before they even figure out how the bureaucracy they're in works. But there's a lot of really important policies that are on the line here involving fair housing. And as we know from Donald Trump's youth, he's not a big fan of fair housing.
But I will say, Paz, though, I mean, Colin, I think, used some key words there. When Ben Carson talked about not wanting to cripple the government, you see with some of these appointments, whether it's to the Education Department or HUD, that perhaps the attempt to cripple the government, to actually change substantively what has been done for years in education or in housing, is the intent here. Is that part of what we should be reading?
Some of these appointments, there's a clear direction, right? Tom Price at HHS, the guy hates the Affordable Care Act. Trump has appointed him to go to HHS and help dismantle, stall, whatever. So we get a glimmer of what was the thought behind that appointment. I have no idea what the nomination of Ben Carson as the secretary at HUD signals on as far as the thinking of Donald Trump. You know, he is not somebody who expressed any thoughts, any policy ideas during the presidential campaign about housing policy, and yet this is Mr. Trump's choice for HUD. So you tell me what it means. And I think that's, you know, that's the game that's going on now in Washington and in much of the rest of the country.
He did, however, compare Ben Carson to a child molester.
Yes, he did.
So one thing I would pay particular attention to is who's making decisions here, or, you know, so there have been several times that Ben Carson has alluded to the fact that Mr. Trump has offered him his choice of positions. And my understanding, at least from listening to, and I think we can get great insights actually from listening to Armstrong Williams, who is essentially Ben Carson's manager.
Or alter ego.
Right. I mean, really. Yeah. But who has said, you know, This was his choice. This was the position that he wanted all along. So then we should really go back, and people, instead of saying, what the heck was Donald Trump thinking, we should be asking, what is Ben Carson thinking? And I think some of this has come out in Ben Carson's, on the road. He has said many, many times, that he feels like, to direct quote, the inner cities are being decimated, and that this is his, there's an opportunity there for him to do something. And so I think maybe this is coming out of some kind of warped sense of, this is how I affect change. Now, the problem with that is, I think, as Paz and Colin have said, is that, HUD is a massive bureaucratic organization. And you just don't, and you can't run it like a corporation or a business. It is a government entity that is rife with all kinds of tangles. And you just don't step in on day one and say, all right, this is what we're doing. And I think there is a really long, messy, ugly road ahead that I would not be necessarily optimistic about.
I mean, one of the questions is, HUD has actually changed its approach from, and this has been going on several administrations, away from massive public housing projects mm-hmm. to more innovative, smaller cooperative, private public partnerships. So that's the question. Well, is there something about that Dr. Carson finds objectionable, that he wants to stop that? The Hope 6 program that have remade some of Hartford's more notorious public housing projects into some pretty nice housing?
Well, the Obama administration also had launched an initiative asking or demanding that that areas receiving HUD money address racial inequalities, and look at the things that are causing racial inequalities. That was kind of a new area for HUD to get into. And just to build on what Leah said, the other thing that Ben Carson said during his campaign was he grew up in poverty and he eventually realized that poverty was a choice. And anybody aware of the structural and ingrained nature of policy of poverty in America would find that a disturbing statement. And I don't know how that translates out into the stuff that Paz is talking about.
That's Colin McEnroe. Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror is here, as is Leah Wright-Rigger from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. When we come back, we'll talk a bit about a new post for Jim Himes, a continued post for Governor Malloy, what it might mean for his prospects for running once again. There's a lot more to talk about in the wheelhouse here on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're here with Leah Wright-Rigger from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, and our own Colin McEnroe. Hey, Colin, what's in your show today?
We have a show that we didn't think was going to produce a lot of acrimony. It's mainly about the Wright brothers and about the fact that they had a sister and what her role was. But we did get kind of drawn into the whole Gustav Whitehead question. He's, of course, Paz often gets snacks from the Gustav Whitehead kiosk at the Legislative Office Building, but he is a guy with a claim to maybe having beaten them into the air. And it turns out the guests are already fighting and they're not even on the show yet.
Is it about Gustav Whitehead's sister?
If we can locate a sister, anybody's sister.
So that's coming up. Flying High with the Colin McEnroe Show this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Connecticut Congressman Jim Himes has been elected head of the centrist New Democrat Coalition in the next Congress. Pez, what's the New Democrat Coalition? I thought New Democrats were all gone. I wasn't sure they were around anymore.
They come back. The New Democratic Coalition is not terribly new. It's been around since the end of the Clinton administration. And look, it's sort of, a successor to the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, which was an attempt that Bill Clinton helped lead to move the party to the center. There's been this, kind of like this low-level forest fire that never quite goes out. The argument between the left and the center and the Democratic Party about what's the smartest way to go. And
I'm just going to stop you quickly and say that whole first segment we did, the one where we were talking about what Donald Trump, who's going to be the next president of the United States, is going to do, isn't that happening in part because the centrist Democrats just got their butts handed to them?
I've read that.
I mean, not in the popular vote, to be clear, but in the end, the Clinton machine, it seems,
right,
has sort of ground to a bit of a halt.
No, that's
here.
True.
And I guess I'm wondering if this is an extension in your mind.
I think
of
the
that.
Question, yeah. the very legitimate question is, do Bill and Hillary Clinton embody the entire New Democratic Coalition or the DLC or the whole idea of centrist Democratic politics? I'm dying to hear Colin go off on that.
You already heard me before the show.
Yeah.
In here yelling just passed before the show started.
Well, keep yelling.
Well, I mean, so first of all, one of the problems with the DLC and with the whatever this thing is called is if you move far away enough from your old core principles, you wake up one morning and it turns out you don't have any principles. And this is one of the problems with Hillary Clinton, that ultimately during this campaign, people were unable to articulate what she stood for. And that's partly a flaw of hers as a candidate, partly a strategy flaw of the campaign, but also partly a flaw of this phenomenon. Everybody knew what Bernie Sanders stood for. Everybody who had even the slightest interest in this campaign could articulate five or six of his major concerns. And to me, this is one of the reasons that this DLC stuff is discredited and really needs to be shown to the exit. You know, it doesn't really mean anything other than this attempt to engage in crypto-truckling behavior towards business while still trying to hold on to other elements of the Democratic base. And it winds up being kind of nothing as a result. I will add to this fact that not that anybody asked him, but Joe Lieberman, who is also a product of this whole thing, chimed in this week saying,
"Here we go."
He was concerned that the left, whatever that is, was going to hijack the Democratic Party. Well, I mean, it's just what you said, John. You know, I mean, the right left, or whatever they want to call themselves, just lost an election because they couldn't articulate a meaningful set of principles, whereas Bernie Sanders energized and engaged a whole bunch of sleeping potential Democratic voters. Who would you bet on in the next cycle?
Leah.
Yeah. So, and I mean, to this point, the right apparently, or alt-right, I don't know what we're calling it now.
There's the right-right, there's the alt-right, and there's beyond
like
the alt-right. Yeah,
we're like in a shoe store.
I know. It's inception politics. So they have energized the party, or at least a cross section of the United States. And I think one of the things to come out of the election is that now is not the time for tiptoeing. Now is not the time to kind of you know pushing towards this weird centrist kind of bland we stand for everything, therefore we stand for nothing. Caveats and compromise and all of this stuff. It's actually time to have a very bold and loud vision. When you have nothing to lose, that's when you have the opportunity to really go full speed ahead. And so this is about, to Colin's point, I think this is about having big ideas, knowing what your ideas stand for. One of the things that got in Hillary Clinton's way is that she did have ideas and no one knew what those ideas were, right? So this became an election that wasn't necessarily about policy, but was an election about personality and about people, and became over time an election about Donald Trump. Democrats have to find something that unites them in a way that allows them to escape that, stranglehold.
But to circle back to Jim Himes, though, is the idea that staking out some center ground, a place where you can work across the aisle, the thing that Joe Lieberman, for years and years before he became an alt Joe Lieberman, talked about. Is there something in a big idea there, Paz, that you can actually, if you're Jim Himes, stake out that place, you have some Wall Street experience, you actually know how to talk to these people, you know how to get things done in Washington. Is that a viable position right now in Washington or in America?
I think if you ask Jim Himes that, he would say it's a piece of the Democratic coalition. I don't think he is, I may be wrong, but I have not heard him make the argument that this is where the whole party should go. This comes at a time when, one of the contenders for the Democratic National Chair is Keith Ellison, a black liberal Muslim from the American heartland. And, the question, do you want a sitting member of Congress to have this position to be literally the face of the Democratic Party and the voice of the Democratic Party? There is that conversation that is continuing. The Republicans had this conversation after Barack Obama's election. They had incredible period of soul searching. They came up with this great plan about what went wrong and what they have to do. And then they nominated a candidate who did the exact opposite of everything in that plan about broadening the base, and he won.
Well, so, and if the embodiment of the centrist Democrat was Hillary Clinton in this incarnation, Jeb Bush was the embodiment of that big tent. We're going to, you know, take a look at how to bring new people in, and that, and right. Jeb Bush lasted for a minute and a half.
This was the change election, and, you know, I think, you know, Leah hinted at it. I mean, it really wasn't about issues. It wasn't about ideas. It was about gut feelings. It was about anger. That's how Donald Trump won. I think he acknowledges that's how he won. He tapped into the zeitgeist this round. Hillary Clinton didn't.
Well, moving on from Jim Himes stepping into this role, Dan Malloy keeping a role, reelected this week to a second one-year term as chairman of the Democratic Governors Association. In a moment, Colin, I suppose we'll talk about what this means for his prospects moving forward and maybe others getting into a governor's race if he decides not to run. But what do you see in Governor Malloy deciding to stay with this sort of money-raising role with the DGA?
I don't know. Paz probably has a closer insight into Malloy at this point than I do. I will say this. It's very important how this goes over the next 2 years, not because just because it's ordinarily very important, but we're heading into 2020, census year, redistricting year, line drawing year. So, I mean, winning governorships, which the Democrats are not very good at, controlling state legislatures, which they've become less and less good at. These are all really, really important things. So my expectation, I mean, Kevin Rennie made the point in his blog this week that this means Malloy is not running because it's such a big job. And I would think that's probably true. I mean, to do this, you know, and to do it right at such a crucial moment means you really have to dedicate a lot of energies to this.
I think Kevin is absolutely right. And if you're raising boatloads of money for the DGA, that means you're not raising money for the Connecticut Democratic Party or your own reelection. And also, look let's just, you know, let's acknowledge the obvious situation. His last poll, his approval rating, he was at 24%.
That's 5 points better than Chris Christie.
Absolutely. Christie set the new record. There should be music playing right now. So, you know, nobody expects Malloy to be seriously looking at – and in fact, you know, if anything, I think that's going to – it's in a weird way, I think that will help him as governor in the next session, because I don't think people are going to be looking at whatever he pushes on the budget as really a political statement. He's going to be freed up, I think, to a large degree.
Leah?
Yeah, so I think I'll go with that too. There's a certain amount of room in having that power and not having the burden on your back, and also just being in a, you know, not so popular guy in the state at this point in the time.
I think that's one way to put it. So who then runs if Governor Malloy decides at a certain point he's not going to run? There's two names that we keep talking about, Colin. One of them is Nancy Wyman, of course, lieutenant governor, much beloved, somebody who Democrats across the board seem to like very, very much. She's certainly much beloved in the labor community. Then there's Kevin Lembo, the state comptroller, who's been sort of hinting at this for a while, and he's got some of his own interesting issues this week to deal with.
Right. Well, I guess we'll come to those.
Yeah.
So I guess I would say about that there is some parallelism between some of the stuff that we've talked about before on this show, I mean today, and the Wyman question, which is, I mean, yes, I think you used the word beloved 16 times. And I would just, you know, I would stipulate that she's beloved. I like her. I'm sure Paz likes her. People who know her like her. She's a very likable politician. She's not really prominently associated with any particular set of issues. She is prominently associated with a guy named Dan Malloy, who, as Paz pointed out, has this, you know, the same approval rating as shingles. So, and you might be making a similar mistake to what the Democrats made in 2016, which is having kind of a centrist person who's not associated with a set of policies and ideas run kind of on a seniority promotion basis. I mean, that's basically what happened this past time in the presidential election. And the understanding, Paz, I think you've heard the same thing. The understanding up at the Capitol right now is that she has right of first refusal, that Lembo probably wouldn't go if she stepped forward and said, no, I really want this. It's my turn. And first of all, I think that's unfortunate. I think nothing but good could come from having them slug it out if they both really wanted it. But, you know, I like Nancy Wyman, too. But I think you might be making a version of the Clinton mistake all over again.
Nancy Wyman, I believe, is 72. I will grant you she is an incredibly energetic and youthful 72, and I have to say that so she doesn't beat on me when I see her next. You know, the whole right of first refusal thing, there's a little bit of kabuki theater going on with that. You know, Kevin Lembo worked for Nancy Wyman in the controller's office. He is loyal. He also knows that bad things tend to happen in Democratic primaries and conventions to people who are seen as rudely shoving out the previous generation. There's a congressman named Bruce Morrison who discovered that when he suggested that Bill O'Neill exit before Mr. O'Neill was ready to make that decision on his own. So, I mean, there's that kind of thing going on. You know, my gut is – I mean, Wyman is keeping her options open. She has not signaled anything. She wants to have her choices available as long as she can. But you're going to have to start raising money pretty soon, at least through an exploratory, because to qualify for public financing, that's the new reality. It takes most people more than a year.
I want to move on to the other issue quickly that I mentioned, Colin, though, that Kevin Lembo this week has been facing, well, a lot of issues within his office. A Mississippi-based charity known for its anti-gay boycotts is targeting the comptroller with a deluge of calls and emails from out-of-state locations, and they're upset about what exactly?
Well, so what they're upset about is that there is something, and Mark knows a lot more about this than I do, but there's something called the Connecticut State Employee Campaign for Charitable Giving. And you want to be able to get on that. In other words, a lot of charities would probably essentially campaign or lobby to get on that list there. It means somebody can check a box or whatever, and some of the money comes out of their paycheck, whatever. So this American Family Association, which, let's be honest, is a hate group. I mean, they have a long jacket from the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is full of really alarming things that they've said, not just about gay people, but also about African Americans. About, I mean, really, this is a very disturbing bunch of people with ties to a lot of even more alarming groups. I don't know. And Paz and I were both saying before the show started, the real mystery is, how did they ever get on this damn list in the first place? Why would the state employees have a box you could check for the American Family Association, who really are just a reprehensible bunch of toads? So, you know, but anyway, basically Lembo said, based on some of that, they should come off. And so they've declared war on him, and this has mobilized a whole bunch of, you know, angry bumpkins.
The irony is there have been exactly three state employees in the last 5 years who have chosen this group for payroll deductions, and I believe that comes to $114. Now, you also can be part of this federation, and you'll get a share of money that goes to that. It's like regional United Way groups. Lembo was responding to a complaint. Somebody noticed this and said, hey, wait a minute. Now, the irony is his mentor, Nancy Wyman, when she was comptroller, she had a similar issue, and she had to do battle with the Boy Scouts of America. Because remember, the Boy Scouts of America, they banned participation by gay kids and gay scout leaders, and that became a thing. So Nancy Wyman, when she was comptroller, actually was sued by the Boy Scouts of America.
And we have to break, Colin, but I just want to say, but there is clearly a difference between organizations where you can pick apart parts of their policy and platform and say, we don't want to support those, and groups like the one that we're talking about here that clearly say some incredibly horrible things about gay people in America.
Yeah. And well, they're also sowing a lot of paranoia. They're claiming things like the Department of Homeland Security is buying millions of rounds of ammunition and possibly planning war against American citizens as part of their critique of the Obama administration. That's who these people are. They're not the boy. I was a Boy Scout, and I was beaten and abused by heterosexual Boy Scouts. So I hold no love for them. But believe me, this is not the Boy Scouts.
And there's another more prosaic issue, which is, do they deliver charitable services?
Yes.
They have a big radio network. You know, there's that question. It's not as sexy as the anti-LGBT stuff, but that's also an issue that Kevin Lembo raised.
Well, I think you raised the issue of some fake news stories coming out. We'll touch on that briefly. We're also going to talk about some interesting things happening at Harvard and Leah's trip overseas to cover the election. There's a lot to talk about in like 10 minutes here on The Wheelhouse with Leah Wright-Rigger, Mark Pasiokas, and Colin McEnroe. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, our own Colin McEnroe, and Leah Wright-Regur, who's assistant professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Campaign managers for the Clinton and Trump campaigns butted heads at a campaign managers conference. I didn't know they had such things at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Here's Jennifer Palmieri from the Clinton campaign and Trump spokesperson Kellyanne Conway.
I would rather lose than win the way you guys did.
No, you wouldn't.
Yes.
That's very clear today. No, you wouldn't, respectfully.
Absolutely.
Do you think I ran a campaign where white supremacists had a platform? Are you going to look me in the face and tell me that?
It did. Kellyanne
really?
Did.
Oh, and that's how you lost?
It did.
Do you think you could have just had a decent message for the white working class voters? Do you think this woman who has nothing in common with
anybody...
I'm not
saying that's why you won, but that's the kind of campaign that was run.
We flipped it over 200. How about it's Hillary Clinton? She doesn't connect with people.
And that was a Harvard conference at your. So what happened, Leah? Were you there, first of all?
So first of all, it was closed off to the public. And so the only people, only invited journalists, CNN and certain people from CNN and the campaign managers were allowed to go. But
I like that you said journalists and CNN. Anyway, please continue.
Poor CNN.
They booed Jeff Zucker.
Yes, they did boo Jeff Zucker and called him a liar and other things. But it happened in the main building. And the interesting, and then there was a big open forum event that was also quite testy. But the interesting part, I think, is how shocked everyone was by how contentious it was. And in some respects, we should have said it. That shouldn't have been surprising. They've been doing these things every 4 years, every presidential election year since 1972, for the historical record. They have, according to Nico Mele, who runs the Shorenstein Center, they've never had one this contentious. I mean, I think if somebody could have picked up a chair and thrown it, that would have happened. A couple of things to take out of this. One, nobody on the Trump team knows why Donald Trump won, right? So even though they say, you know, everything was an example of this is why he won, this is why he won, there were also several points where they said, you know, we thought the campaign was over after he did that. We didn't understand why. And everyone had different reasons.
Well, even the end of what Conway is saying there, if your candidate had just run, I mean, it's almost as though they're goading them, saying, if you just want to run a better campaign, we wouldn't have to be dealing with the fact that we won.
Exactly. I also thought it was interesting that you know, Kellyanne Conway said in that piece, you know, maybe if your candidate had just appealed to the white working class, right? Which was a really interesting, like, it's been rarer for them to say that after the election, like, that's what they did. And yet, here she is, nakedly admitting it. I think the other thing, too, is that everyone is still very angry. I was really shocked by how angry the Trump team was, considering that their candidate won. They were very defensive and very angry.
Old habits die hard.
Exactly.
Well, Paz?
The only thing that was missing from that was alcohol.
One thing that I would say, if you're – the Shorenstein Center has all of the audios. I think it's in SoundCloud form on their site. It's really worth listening to even more – if you can handle this anyway, it's even worth listening to even more of it. I mean, these sessions
– No, don't.
Get the highlight reel.
As Leah says, these sessions historically have been – it's a little bit more like the end of an NFL game where these people have been trying to break each other's arms and legs for 3 hours, start hugging each other. So typically what they do at these sessions, or like you turn over your cards and say, well, here's what I actually had, you know, like the Romney people 4 years ago said, well, you know, your data operation was a lot better. And now that we're here listening to you, it's even better than we thought it was. That's how you beat us. That tends to be the tenor of these things. I will say that the line of the day is Leah's about how the Trump team doesn't know why they won. You know, Paz and I have covered so many campaigns where the campaign thought it was going to win and it lost. All right. That's the pattern. That was Romney. Romney thought he absolutely was going to win on election day in 2012. He thought he was going to win. That always happens, that they overestimate their chances. I don't think I've ever known a campaign that thought it was going to lose. And one, can you think of one?
No. I mean, the fact that the first thing they did after they won, they said, oh my God, I have Christie in charge of transition. Let's change that. I want to agree with Colin and disagree. I agree with Colin that Leah had the line of the day about the takeaway from that. But I want to repeat in the strongest possible terms, ladies and gentlemen, for the sake of your mental health, for the sake of your children, for the sake of the holidays, do not go and listen to that audio.
Look, there's so much left to talk about in just the last couple of minutes. And what I'm going to do is move the story about the MDC and water to another program, because I think there's plenty to talk about there. I just want to say, because I want everyone's reaction here. I've had a lot of situations recently where I've been in front of groups of people, donors here at the station, students of the Connecticut Forum, everyone who wants to talk about fake news. People keep asking me about fake news. It's a big concern, but people are somewhat dismissive of it. They're saying, well, Americans should be smarter, they should be better news consumers, etc. But not all fake news is equal. There's a case of a guy this week who comes into a Washington, D.C. pizza restaurant and fires shots and threatens people because he's convinced that there's truth to a fake story that links the pizza chain to the Clintons and a child sex ring. That's a story that people believe, millions of people believe. You know who spreads that kind of story? Radio host Alex Jones, someone who's been praised by Donald Trump. His consistent spreading of lies has a real impact when something like this happens. You know what else Alex Jones tells people? He tells people that the shooting at Sandy Hook, the one that we all lived through, was a hoax. He says it doesn't happen. It didn't happen, and millions of people seemingly believe that. That's not, I don't think, Colin, fringe or outsider thinking. That's not even a conspiracy theory. That's the worst kind of thing that somebody can say. And it seems as though now that's something we're dealing with on a daily basis. This guy going in and threatening people in D.C., that's a consequence of people believing something that is patently not true.
Right. So the problem with fake news is not that it tipped the election. At least I don't believe that. I think it basically wound up talking to people who already believed a lot of the same kinds of things. The problem is the one that you're describing, that it emboldens a certain group of people. And they're some of the same people who are writing hateful things to Kevin Lembo right now.
Yep.
They're some of the same people who are sending horrible letters to mosques, like the one that went various places, including down to the New Haven area. And they feel as though the scales have tipped and that their version of reality and history is more legitimized and more pursuable in broad daylight than it was in the past, that they don't have to live in the shadows anymore, which frankly is where they belong. And I think that's the concern, that the Comet Ping Pong incident is a guy who thought, you know, I have every right to go and find out whether this is true and shoot my shotgun into the floor.
Paz?
Look, Trump's national security advisor is going to be Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. And General Flynn's son, also named Michael Flynn, was on the Trump transition team. And both Flynns, father and son, have fallen prey to these fake news. Now, the younger Flynn was fired from the transition team because he forwarded this story. However, the elder Flynn is still the gentleman who is going to be delivering the daily intelligence briefing to the president of the United States for the next 4 years, unless President Trump changes his mind. General Flynn, time and time again, has indicated he accepts many of these stories as true. He is in charge of intelligence. Just absorb that for a moment.
Yeah. So this is what I was saying. When you go from the fringes to the mainstream, that's when you have a really significant problem. And when you have people on who are in charge of classified information, who are exposed to classified information, sharing false stories and talking about them as if they were true, that's when we have a real problem. And I think that there's – I don't know what we have to do about them, but we have to do something about it, whether it's holding Donald Trump accountable. He has praised Alex Jones multiple times. He's also praised several of the other people involved in these false stories or for spreading these false stories. There has to be some way to dig through this and, you know, put it back at the fringes or off altogether where it belongs.
Yeah, I just have to say, in a week in which there was a mistrial in the Walter Scott shooting case, the fact that a guy is able to go in to a restaurant because he believes a fake news story and fire off rounds and be, I assume, peaceably arrested is something that probably should also make an awful lot of people take pause. Leah, we just have less than a minute left, but I have to ask you, you absorbed all this from a very interesting seat this election. You were at Al Jazeera halfway around the world.
Oh, it was crazy. And I think we knew much earlier than people in the United States knew about the election results. So by the time North Carolina started looking shaky, we actually knew that it was probably going to go Trump's way. And part of the way that we knew is that Hillary Clinton's surrogate team stopped calling, and all of a sudden Donald Trump's surrogate started calling, just lighting the phones up, would not put the phones down, wanted to talk about everything and anything.
It must have been the strangest night in a very strange place. Leah Wright-Rigger at the very boisterous Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Thank you, Leah, for joining us. Also, thanks to Mark Pazdiokas at the staid Connecticut Mirror, Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on on WNPR. Thanks to Katie Talarski and Kyle Wolf, who produce our show. This is The Wheelhouse.